Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and welcome to a very special episode of All Things Marine. I can't believe today is our 50th episode and that we've been doing this for almost 4 years now. Today we will catch up with previous guests from the past to discuss what they're doing now and what's happened since the last show they were on. The All Things Marine radio show started when I first met Jeff Davis at the Ocean Expo in 2012. He came over to the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology booth where I was working at the time and asked if I could cover an episode. One episode turned into a monthly gig, and here we are today with our program running strong. So let's hop into our time machine and visit the past with some of six guests that we've been able to interview previously. First up is Dr. Nissa Silberger. You remember Nissa from our first show in May 2012 when she came to talk about her interesting PhD research using CT scans of coral blocks to look at accretion and bioerosion rates in the reef. Nissa is now a postdoc scholar at the Ecology and Evolutionary Department at the University of California in Irvine, working with in collaboration with the Sorti Lab. Nissa is spending her summer doing field work along the west coast of the United States in a camper van, which I'm really excited to hear about. So, Nissa, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Carly, and congratulations on your 50th episode. Quite amazing.
Thanks. We're very excited about that. Now, it's been a few years since we last talked, but I first want to know, how does camping and science go together?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I am actually calling you right now from the coast of Oregon. I have been living out of a camper van with two of my lab mates over the last month or so, and we'll be again for another 20 days. Conducting science in the intertidal, living in a camper van that was donated to us by GoSC. It's been quite an amazing adventure, and it's really great to be able to have a lab that moves with you as well as a place to sleep.
Now, that's pretty exciting. I've been following a little bit on social media what you've deemed the biobus, and how are you using the biobus? So what exactly are you doing as you make your way along the West Coast?
Yeah, absolutely. So myself and one of my lab mates, Piper Wallingford, and also a recent undergraduate student from our lab, Savannah Todd, we've been looking at intertidal communities all up and down the West Coast. So we've literally been traveling from San Diego all the way up, and we're about to go all the way up to northern Washington. And so the biobus is literally our laboratory on wheels, our home, our kitchen, everything combined up in one. So we've been working out of it, living in it, and taking it to these amazing remote sites that just would not be possible without having the camper van.
Well, hopefully you're keeping your water and your lab samples separate.
Yes, we are.
So what exactly are you looking at? Are you still doing work with corals, or what exactly are you doing as you hit these field sites?
Yeah, so over here, I'm not working with corals. I'm still collaborating on coral projects in Hawaii because I just absolutely cannot give that up. Corals are definitely my first science love, and we'll continue to work with those. But here I'm in temperate, rocky intertidal systems. So they're really different, really cool systems that literally mean in between the tides. So these intertidal systems are exposed to air half the day and underwater the other half of the day. And so they experience stressors both from the marine and the terrestrial environment. And so what I'm looking at is tide pools and trying to understand how organisms actually shape the environment around them just by breathing and just by photosynthesizing.
Excellent. Well, it sounds really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about the differences between the tide pools that you're looking at now versus some of the tide pools that maybe we would see in Hawaii?
Yeah, absolutely. So tide pools in Hawaii are filled with coral reef organisms. So you might see things like ahoehoe, the little fish that use them as juvenile housing, use them when they're juveniles, and you'll see also somewhat corals living in them as well. Here, we're in cold temperate systems, so we don't have coral reefs out here. Instead, we have these amazing mats of intertidal algae, and we have mussels and barnacles and sea anemones and crabs and snails and all these other really cool organisms that thrive on these high nutrient cold conditions that you just don't see in Hawaii.
Excellent. And of course, colder water.
Of course, colder water, way colder. So the water that we were working in yesterday was about 49 degrees relative to what you would see in Hawaii, which is in the mid-70s. So a lot different environment.
So I'm assuming you're working a little quicker when you're doing your field work.
Oh, I wish. We're out for a long time, but I'm wearing probably 6 layers of clothes here as opposed to, you know, a bathing suit or a wetsuit when I'm working in Hawaii.
Excellent. Well, both sound like really exciting ecosystems to be doing work in. Now, I know you're going by quantitative marine ecologist these days. Now, explain to us what is a quantitative marine ecologist do?
So I'm basically just a marine ecologist that likes math. That's probably the best way to explain that. I try to ask questions that I can answer using interesting statistics and modeling techniques. So that's pretty much what a quantitative marine ecologist means.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that there are people out there that can do that. And I myself struggle a little bit. But so 4 years ago, you were talking about these bioerosion and accretion systems that you were looking at for your doctorate work. Have you seen changes in the reef systems that you've been working in over the past 4 years?
Yeah, you know, that's a really great question. And absolutely. These last 4 years have been really interesting for quarries, especially in Hawaii. You had a couple of guests on your show, I think last year, talking about some of the massive leaking events that have been happening. And this is something that's been quite intense over the last several years. We've had several mass leaching events in Hawaii since I've talked to you last. And so I think probably that's one of the biggest changes that's happened since I've talked to you on the radio show back in 2012 is the abundance of these leaching events that are happening so close together.
Definitely noticeable as well, and something that we hope doesn't continue for too long. So
yeah,
what are some of the biggest take-homes or things that you've learned from your PhD work that you're now incorporating into some of your postdoc research?
Yeah, so my PhD work, like you said, it focused on, you know, the balance between how fast coral reefs grow and how fast they're being broken down. And I think for me, one of the biggest take-home messages that I got was to kind of take a step back and look at the bigger picture of the system that you're working on. You know, a lot of times we get stuck in the details of the very specifics of the organism we're studying or the very specific question, you know, just how fast corals are growing, just how fast they're being broken down. But if we really want to understand, you know, how a whole system is working, we really need to be talking to other scientists and thinking about, you know, not just the growth process, but the growth and the breakdown process. And so for me, for my postdoc, the way that I'm taking this in is, like I said, I'm looking at how organisms change the environment around them. And looking at big picture, I'm looking at this both during the day and during the night. Because we need to see how organisms change environments, you know, across space and time and in different ways. So that's probably one of the biggest things that I think that I learned about my research and the big picture, at least.
Well, looking big picture, what is next for you? What on the research agenda? Are you just going to keep moving your way north as you keep doing field work? Or what's the next plan?
Keep moving to the cold. I'm really interested in all coastal marine ecosystems. I mean, coral reefs are where my heart is, and I'm learning so much about the intertidal, and I just want to keep learning more and more about how, you know, our coastal ecosystems affect the world that we live in and how we are affecting them.
So where can people go if they want to know more about the BioBus or follow you along on your adventures?
Absolutely. So if you go to www.thebiologybus.com, you can see all about our adventures up the coast. Or if you look at hashtag the BioBus on Twitter or Instagram, you can see all sorts of fun posts and pictures from the field.
Excellent. Before we let you go, I have to ask, do you have a dedicated mix or music that you're listening to as you travel while you're doing your science?
Oh, man. Okay. So those of you that know me know I have quite an eclectic taste in music. We've been listening to, you know, all sorts of jock jams and really fun 90s music, also podcasts. And I really got into Serial recently because I haven't listened to that yet. So basically anything we can get our hands on when you're traveling for 2 months, you know, in a car. You kind of want to listen to everything.
I love it. An eclectic mix from education and, you know, stories to alternative 90s. Fantastic.
That's right.
Thank you so much for taking some time out of your schedule to join us, and we look forward to following your adventures.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Carly.
Thanks. Talk to you soon. With us now is another PhD candidate, or soon to be graduating, maybe even graduated, we'll find out, from the University of Hawaii, who we had on the show quite some time ago, Adrian Copeland. Adrian was on the show in March 2014 when she was acting as chief scientist of a cruise on board of research vessel Falkor. That was also a very special show for us as we had Dr. Sylvia Earle on the air with us. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Carly. It's exciting to be here for the 50th episode.
I'm so happy to have you. So first, are you finished? Are you finishing? Where are you at?
So I submitted my dissertation back in July, but
congrats.
Thank you. But technically, I get my PhD this Friday, so I'm really excited.
Well, great timing. Congratulations.
Thank
so
you.
What's the first thing you'll do to celebrate?
Not have to write anymore? No, I don't know. Maybe take a break for a day.
That sounds excellent. So tell us a little bit about what you've been writing on.
Yeah, so I was really interested in better understanding the behavior of deep diving tooth whales in Hawaii. So in Hawaii, there is three species in particular that I was interested in studying, and that was sperm whales, beaked whales, and short fin pilot whales. And each of these species dive down below 400 meters to feed. And we wanted to know why they're going to these locations and diving so deep to feed on squid and other organisms at depth. So we looked at both geography and oceanography, so currents and sea surface temperature, to understand the distribution of organisms called micronecton. They're these small organisms, about 2 to 20 centimeters. They're small crustaceans and squid and fish that seem to attract larger things like cephalopods that these deep diving tooth whales feed on. So we wanted to look at their distribution and try to link that to these deep diving tooth whales to see if there's hot spots of biology that are attracting whales to the area. And we did see that distance from land and bathymetry really affected the distribution of these small organisms, and it seemed to be linked to the foraging or the feeding behavior of these tooth whales. And these tooth whales seemed to be actually associated inshore where these hotspots were.
So if I am a deep diving toothed whale, where are my hotspots? Where is all the food at?
Yeah, so that's the ultimate question, right? So unfortunately, because they feed on cephalopods that are very quick and hard to study because they're below 400 meters where the light doesn't penetrate, we can't really look at their actual food distribution. So we want to answer that question, but we can use micronecton as a proxy, hopefully. And it seems like areas inshore, like off the island of Hawaii, have a high hotspot area of these micronecton and a lot of large whales.
That makes sense. Well, all the large whales I've seen have been off Hawaii Island. So, and are all whales deep diving or just the three that you focused on?
Yeah, so in Hawaii, those three are deep diving as well as the Risos dolphin. All other species forage mostly at the surface. So many dolphins will feed on organisms at the surface.
Excellent. And looking back on it, what are some of the biggest impacts of this work? So now that you've done the research, will this help create more protected areas in certain regions? Or what? How are you going to apply this research?
Yeah, so the marine mammals are protected, but there's really little known about the behavior of these deep diving tooth whales. So the goal is to have a better understanding of what areas they're focusing on to feed, so that way we can actually protect them and avoid those areas if needed.
And for those of us in academia, we know once you finish your study or finish a PhD, the next step is to really get out there and publish those results. Do you have any plans to do that?
Yeah. So we've actually, so my dissertation will have three different publications that are all in prep right now. We're actually going to submit one probably next week or so, which we're really excited about. And that one actually focused on some work we did off the island of Hawaii. And in some September time, we're actually going back there on another research cruise to further expand on that data and learn more about this link between maka to makai, or land to ocean.
Isn't that the best part, is the more you learn, the more questions you have,
yes.
The more research that needs to be done. And were you just focusing on Hawaii, or are there other spots that you're applying this research to as well?
Yeah, so my specific studies looked the main Hawaiian Islands as well as the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, and I did some work as well in the Gulf of Mexico. And we saw a similar relationship actually in the three different areas where distance to land seemed to affect the biology.
Interesting. And any obvious differences or similarities between the main Hawaiian Islands and the northwestern Hawaiian Islands?
Yeah, so it was really interesting. We actually want to expand on that more. We saw that the northwestern Hawaiian Islands seemed to have more biomass or more micronecton in the water column, and it also seemed to be more detections of these large whales. So we did have more detections of sperm whales than we would see in the main Hawaiian Islands. So we want to look into that more and see if there is actually more food for these whales to feed on in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands.
Amazing. And you mentioned you have another cruise coming up. I know when you were on the show last, you were serving as chief scientist. How was that experience for you? And do you have any plans to take the chief sci role again?
Yeah, so I really enjoyed and loved the opportunity from the Falkor to act as chief scientist. It was a great opportunity, and I was one of their first students to be chief scientist on their ship. This upcoming cruise in September, I will be acting as the lead for the acoustics team, but not as chief scientist. I have too much data to focus on right now, so I appreciate just being a lead.
Absolutely. And so now you're graduating, you're going out on this cruise in September. What else is on the horizon for you?
Yeah, so there's actually a lot coming up. So next week I actually start a postdoc as a ecosystem researcher working in collaboration with the University of Hawaii and with the Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center. And I'll be doing that until February 2017. And then in February I actually start the CANALS Fellowship, which is a collaborative program between Sea Grant and NOAA. And it looks at doing marine policy in Washington, D.C. So I'll be able to better understand how policy and budget actually affects the science that I do.
That's incredible. It's a very prestigious fellowship. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And we wish you a lot of luck in D.C. We've got lots of people going from the warm to the cold.
Yeah, I'm nervous about that. Well, I'm excited.
Hopefully you'll continue to keep up the great work here in Hawaii. We're going to take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we will be learning more about our past guests.
Quarterback looking, firing across the middle. Wow, what a grab in traffic. Larson really had defenders hanging all over, but somehow he comes up with the football.
On the football field, you've got to stay focused and not get distracted.
NFL Hall of Famer and President and CEO of CTIA, the Wireless Association, Steve Largent.
The same is true on the road. So before your wireless phone becomes a distraction, take a time out for safety. Place your phone in easy reach before you leave. Never take notes or look up a phone number while you're driving. In bad weather or traffic, call later. Dial sensibly and use a hands-free device. You know, your wireless phone can be your best safety tool to call for help, stop a crime, or help someone in need. However you use it, remember, with wireless, safety is your call.
The wireless industry reminds you to drive safely. For more information, visit www.wirelesssafety.org.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and welcome back to our very special 50th episode anniversary of All Things Marine. With us now is another guest from back in March 2013, Dr. Philip Thompson, came and talked to us about climate change and sea level rise. Phil is now the Associate Director of the Sea Level Center, and actually, well, he's also now my husband. So welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Carly. I'm actually kind of curious whether or not being your husband now gets me the title of Marine Science Guy. Is that how that works? Or am I just merely Mr. Marine Science Gal?
I think we can give you Marine Science Guy. Sure. That will work. So tell us a little bit about the Sea Level Center and the different types of work that you do.
Well, we do a variety of things. First and foremost, we are a data center. So we work with a variety of agencies and governments around the world that provide us with tide gauge data, sea level data, collected from those instrumentation in various places. And then we take in that data, we quality control it, and then serve it out to users and researchers that want to do something with that data. We also contribute to the Global Sea Level Observing System. So that's a system of tide gauges all around the world. We have about 80 tide gauges that we operate and maintain. And the National Ocean Service takes care of most of the U.S. coastline, but we actually have gauges in island locations in the Indian, Pacific, Atlantic oceans, and some of them are quite remote. Our technicians have to spend, you know, a few days on a cargo ship getting there and have to stay there for a week until they wait for the next ship to come. So it's quite an investment. And then we also do a lot of research as well on various aspects of climate and sea level, looking at anything from like long-term sea level rise to short-term El Nino events, all these kinds of things. And, you know, we're trying to get more into applied research, something that's a little more, you know, actionable for community members and policymakers. So that's kind of our current direction.
Excellent. And the tide gauges, do they just measure sea level or do they measure other things as well?
Well, they measure sea level, but within those measurements are a lot of different processes. So they're measuring a single measurement at the coastline in a single place, but that includes global sea level rise. But locally, it includes the tides. It can include if there's a storm nearby and you have winds along shore can change the sea level. Anything from atmospheric pressure changing can change sea level as well. And then you have like large scale sort of sloshing redistribution of ocean volume within the basins that can change it as well.
Excellent. So now, sounds like the Sea Level Center is doing a lot. What specifically have you been working on since last time you've been on the show?
Well, I work on a lot of different problems. One of the things that a lot of people don't think about right away when they think of sea level is that it doesn't change the same way in every place at the same time. And there are lots of different reasons for that. You can have large-scale wind patterns over the ocean that can cause sea level to go up in one place and down in another. Another process would be melting of ice sheets. So melting of a glacier or an ice sheet, these things are so massive, they actually distort the surface of the ocean. And so these things have so much gravity that they actually pull the water towards them where the ice is, and you create a deficit of water away from the ice. So when these things melt, then the sea level falls actually closest to the ice, and then it rises in the far field or far away from the glaciers or ice sheets. And so these types of patterns have an impact on local sea level. And so one of the things we've been working on is to see, you know, over the 20th century, we have these really long, great tide gauge records. Do these processes affect what we measure? And what we found is that that can actually cause a long tide gauge record, most of the good ones that we have, to underestimate sea level rise by a little bit over the 20th century.
And so these records that you have, do they allow you to make predictions for the future?
Yeah, well, most of the predictions we have for the future are based on models, not necessarily the past data. That's how we predict for the future. And there are lots of different types of climate models. Most of them are predicting right now about, you know, a half meter to a meter of sea level rise over the 21st century. But there are some scientists who think that maybe there are thresholds we might hit where the mechanisms between ocean warming and the amount of ice that we have and how these ice sheets kind of hang over into these warmer areas of the ocean may cause instability, and we could hit a threshold where you have rapid ice loss. But a lot of that is sort of ongoing research in the community. At the Sea Level Center right now, in terms of predictions, we're actually focused more on seasonal to decadal timescales, the kind of timescales that are more actionable for people. People are actually making decisions. You know, when you make decisions in policy, it's really hard to get anything passed for 100 years from now, right? So really what we need is people timescales. And so that's kind of more seasonal to decadal type of stuff. We just hired a guy, a researcher, Matthew Wodlansky, who's working on decadal predictions and doing a great job with that. I'm working on a project right now where we are trying to create seasonal forecasts of wave-induced inundation that we can add on top of mean sea level. So like I said, with the tide gauges, there are all these different processes that are there in the data. But if you want to make predictions, you have to predict the tides, you have to predict the mean sea level, so that's changes due to winds and things like that. And then you have to predict on top of that wave events. And so we're trying to bring all those different processes together to create something that's useful for people in making decisions.
So those predictions, are they more local-based with bringing in wave and wind, or is that also on a global scale?
Right now, we're focused on on Hawaii and the U.S. affiliated Pacific Islands. We're doing things in American Samoa and Guam, Saipan, and then obviously Hawaii. We are working on a proposal, though, to try to get some funding to do this on a wider scale. Maybe try to expand this to the east and the west coast of the United States. So that's something we're looking to do.
And any tidbits or little pieces of information you can share with us from your findings about Hawaii?
Well, a lot of that is sort of just getting underway in terms of creating those forecasts. So we're kind of working on that at the moment.
Okay. And so then what's next in terms of new projects? You have this that you're working on, but anything else, any projects or presentations that are going to be starting this fall?
So I'm going to France in the fall, to La Rochelle, to the NASA OSTST meeting. And that's a group of scientists and engineers who work on looking at sea level from satellites that are revolving around the Earth in space. And we can measure sea level globally now with these satellites to really an impressive degree of accuracy. It's really amazing the kind of engineering that goes into these measurements. And so that's a meeting of engineers and scientists who work on that problem. I submitted a couple abstracts to that meeting, so we'll see how that goes.
And you said OTS or OST?
Sorry. It's the Ocean Surface Topography Science Team. Okay. So it's quite a mouthful, so I just went with the acronym.
Okay.
I'm also getting into hydrology a little bit, which is something that's kind of new to me. With climate events like El Nino or La Nina, you have changes in precipitation patterns that can affect the amount of rain that you receive on the oceans versus the land, and that can change, you know, in time. And so that actually can affect global sea level, surprisingly. So with a La Nina or an El Nino event, you can have so much rain on land that gets soaked up. The land just acts like a sponge and can soak it up. You can reduce global sea level by 5 to 10 centimeters, which is not a small signal, you know, over the when you think about that averaged over the entire global surface of the ocean. So what that means is that when you have these types of these large fluctuations, that can really mask the climate signals that we're interested in, like acceleration, you know, if you want to see acceleration due to ice sheet melting and things like that. And so that's something we're working on to try to pull out those kind of high frequency large signals due to short term fluctuations and leave behind the kind of climate signals that we're interested in studying.
Wow, it sounds super interesting. And that's kind of the first I've heard about, you know, rainfall affecting some of the sea levels. So I'm excited to hear more about that.
Well, I'm sure you will.
Well, over dinner, at least.
Right.
Well, thanks for coming back on the show, Phil. With us now is also an alum from the All Things Marine, Alan Andrews. Alan joined us back in December 2013, where he talked about some very cool radiocarbon work that he was doing with fish. Alan is a research fish biologist in the Life History Program at NOAA. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Carly. It's great to be here.
Well, we are excited to have you back. And I know I ran into you recently at the Coral Reef Symposium, and you shared some really interesting stuff that you've been up to. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you've been doing with radiocarbon data?
So with the radiocarbon data, we've been exploring establishing records across the Pacific and specifically out into the U.S. territories. The method that I use is called BOM radiocarbon dating. So we're tracing the change in naturally occurring radiocarbon levels over the Pacific through recent time as a time-specific marker to age fish. And so with Hawaii, we've got some recently established records. We can validate the age of some species, and there's some innovative stuff that I can tell you about in a few minutes that we're starting to apply now. But we're also trying to do stuff in areas like Guam and American Samoa. So we've got a new coral record from Guam that we're starting to apply to other fish species there too.
Excellent. And so just fish species, or do you do this work with corals as well?
Yeah. So the baseline that we establish as a chronometer for when the radiocarbon changed from nuclear testing is from coral records. So the coral records, we know that they grow at about a centimeter per year. And you can validate the annual change in temperature with other isotopic measurements to create an independent timeline from the coral of what the environmental radiocarbon levels were. And then we use that as a reference for aging fish, where we use the fish ear bone, which is called the otolith, as a proxy for when the fish was born.
Excellent. And radiocarbon dating, for those of us that don't know, so what's sort of the understanding behind it? How do you do radiocarbon data besides looking at the fish bones? What exactly are you looking for?
Yeah, so with radiocarbon, there's naturally occurring levels of radiocarbon, which is a radioactive isotope of carbon. It's carbon-14. And so prior to atmospheric testing of thermonuclear devices in the 50s, there was naturally occurring levels. But in the 50s and 60s, the testing actually doubled the naturally occurring amounts. And so we have this big signal. And so that detecting that radiocarbon signal is what we're looking for to age the fish.
And so sites like Guam and Hawaii, these are areas where they did a lot of, is it radiocarbon testing or some of the bomb testing, and that's where you're getting that information from?
So actually it's the testing that most of the testing happened at Bikini and Anuitok in the Pacific Proving Grounds, high altitude testing over the Pacific. The Russians did a lot of testing over northern Siberia. Those signals are all averaged together by mixing in the atmosphere. And it's the signal that from all of those tests that work their way back into the marine environment, sort of on average, shows this slow, steady decline over a period of about 10 years. Then once atmospheric testing was stopped in 1963, now it's going back down again. So we have this peak and then a decline. And so it's not a local phenomenon that we're chasing.
Interesting. And so I guess that phenomenon will also change, that you can, you know, now that it's going back down, you'll only have this window of time that'll really be able to give you that information that you're looking for.
Right. So the rise time, which is typically late 50s to about 1970, the rise of radiocarbon, that's a very time-specific window. So you have to have fish that were born in that 10-year window in order to use it. So now, as that time period gets pushed further back in time, we have to have either otolith archives or marine organism archives that go back far enough to register that signal, or we can have fish that are long enough lived to have been alive now that were alive then. And it turns out that's the case in quite a few situations. We have fish that were over 50 years old.
Wow, that's incredible. So you mentioned Guam and a few other places. Are there plans to go anywhere else in the Pacific to do this work?
Yeah, so we're looking at American Samoa. We need to do some work with the fisheries down there. There is a radiocarbon record that exists in the area that other researchers have established, and so we're looking at using that as a reference for validating the age of reef and bottom fishes in that area as well.
And this seems like a pretty unique area of study. Are there a lot of researchers looking at this, or is it kind of a small community that's focused on this type of work?
Yeah, so it's definitely a small community. I do work not just in Hawaii, but I've done work on the Great Barrier Reef, now doing work in the Indian Ocean with colleagues in Western Australia and also in South Africa. I've been investigating the radiocarbon signal in the Mediterranean. And I should say that the signal is different in each place. How the radiocarbon record worked its way back into the marine environment is different. So we have to come up with a reference in each of these places. And so that's an important consideration.
Excellent. Now, I know you have a paper in the Journal of Geophysical Research. Is that some of the work that you shared at the Coral Reef Symposium, or is this something new?
Yes. So I did present it at the Coral Reef Symposium, and it's a bit of an interesting paper because it's more about radiocarbon and oceanography as opposed to having any kind of fish validation. As an artifact of setting up the record for Guam as a reference to aged fish, I discovered these three radiocarbon spikes that went way above what you normally would consider natural air-sea diffusion. So that filtered signal that went back into the marine environment slowly, that wasn't the case in Guam. It was punctuated by these three peaks. And it turns out that each one of those peaks can be tied to specific test periods at Bikini and Anuitok. So there's fallout radiocarbon that was advected in the North Pacific Current that made its way through and around to Guam. And so that paper looks at tracing those signals, not just to Guam, but to also to other places throughout the Indo-Pacific.
Excellent. What an interesting mix of research. It's really fascinating to me. So what's next on the agenda with this method, or what's next for you research-wise?
Yeah, so I guess one of the things that we're exploring now, we pointed out the fact that the utility of the technique for aging fish is starting to go further and further back in time. Well, it turns out that in the North Pacific, the decline side actually has a fair enough steep angle so that we can start to age younger, more recently collected fish. And so right now I'm working with Ed DeMartini at NOAA Fisheries as well, and we're working on some of the local parrotfish species like the red lip and the spectacled parrotfishes, which are a couple of the largest species here in Hawaii. There are age estimates, and so what we're doing is looking at radiocarbon from these really, really small otoliths. So we're starting to push the limits of being able to extract the proper carbonate as well as get measurements from them. And so we're trying to age these fish that are maybe only 1 or 2 decades old as opposed to 40 or 50 or 60 years old.
And what's the oldest fish that you've ever found that you've been working with?
Yeah, a couple of deep water fishes, and this is with a completely different technique called lead radium dating. We validated that the orange ruffy lives to be well over 100 years old, and then a couple of rockfish species like the yellow eye rockfish lives to be over 100 years old as well.
Wow, those are some long-living fish.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, we wish you a lot of success with this work. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be catching up more with some guests from our past.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice,
what if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today is a very special episode for us, 50 episodes on air. And we are talking to past guests and getting some updates from what they've been doing. And we've been so lucky to have fantastic people from Hawaii and elsewhere in the world over the last 4 years. And I'm really, really pleased to introduce our next guest, Dr. Rob Tonin, one of the leading scientists in the marine genetics field. Rob is an assistant research professor at University of Hawaii's Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, and not only is an amazing scientist, but big supporter of the show. Thank you so much for being here, Rob.
Thank you so much for having me, Carly. It's fun to be back.
So, Rob, can you talk a little bit closer to the mic there? Excellent. All right. We just want to be able to hear everything you have to say. And it's been a while since you've been last on the show. When you were here a couple years ago, talking about genetic barriers across the Hawaiian archipelago, is this something that you're still working on, or what's new in your life?
It is. So when we first talked, we had done a bunch of genetic work and tried to understand if we were to catch fish on the island of Oahu, where's the next generation of fish going to repopulate from so that we can continue to have food. And our work at that time, we had only done about 10 species, and what we were seeing were differences between islands. And our lab has continued to work on this, and a lot of great graduate students working on these projects to try to understand what is the pattern of exchange, and do we get any help from neighbor islands? And we've now looked at over 50 species of coral reef organisms, lots of different fishes. And what we're finding is that island by island in the main Hawaiian islands, we stand alone. We're not getting any help on Oahu from Maui or from Big Island in terms of spillover that people were hoping. And in fact, what we have to look at is if we're going to manage our fisheries, what we do on Oahu matters to Oahu. And we have to look after our own backyard because we're not getting help from neighbors.
Interesting. Well, very important information in terms of thinking about regional management. And clearly you've been very busy, because when I was working with you guys, you had only done 12 species or something like that. So 50 is quite an impressive number.
Yeah. So, and it's a lot of work from a lot of different students that people have been working on. The other thing that we've been really trying to work on over the last 5 years has basically been trying to understand what are the species in Hawaii. A lot of the things have the same species name as they do on other islands, our corals, for example. But when we actually look at the genetics of some of these things, what we're finding is that some things are not the same as they're called elsewhere, and that a snapper in Samoa may not be the same as a snapper here. And in fact, we found that there are a lot of species that appear to be Hawaiian endemics. They're only found in Hawaii when we've actually looked at the genetics, and that they're not these broadly distributed species. We actually have more biodiversity in Hawaii. And we're finding the same thing on a lot of the small reef invertebrates and small creatures that live out on Hawaii's reefs.
Well, so that's really fascinating, because we already have a pretty large endemism or high rate of endemism here. Do you think that it's actually higher than what we've originally predicted?
I believe it probably is, that we have one of the highest rates of endemism in fishes in the world. And the reality is that there's lots of interest in fishes, and lots of people study fish. Most of what I study is all of the worms and snails and slugs and grubby stuff that lives down in the reef. And the fact is that most people don't study those, and they don't get that excited about it. And we still have very little idea of most of the biodiversity that's living in the reef. About 90% of the species that live down in the reef, we don't actually know whether or not those things are widely distributed, broadly distributed species, or whether those things are Hawaiian endemics. And the fact is, most people just haven't looked.
Interesting. Well, definitely say that the invertebrates are equally as cool as the fish. And if you don't believe me, check out some of the images from the Papahana Mokuakea Marine National Monument, because those divided flatworms, and even you gave me an appreciation for sea cucumbers, they are equally cool. So I have to ask, go off script a little bit here. I know there's also a lot of genetics work between the main and northwestern Hawaiian Islands and Johnston Atoll. Is Johnston Atoll still this big question mark, or where does good old Johnston play into all of it?
I think it's becoming less and less of a question mark. What we've got now for quite a number of species is Johnston Atoll seems to serve both as a stepping stone into Hawaii for some species. It basically is a jumping off point for Indo-Pacific species trying to recruit to Hawaii. It gives them an area to get a foothold, and for some of the fish species to actually finally make that final step into Hawaii and colonize Hawaii. It also seems to be an outpost of Hawaiian diversity and a gateway for species to make it out of Hawaii. And some species, like the yellow tang, which is sort of a Hawaiian cultural icon in terms of fishes here, turns out that it looks like it was a Hawaiian endemic that's actually escaped Hawaii and made it out into the broader Pacific Islands and is now found other places from starting its origin, its evolutionary origins in Hawaii.
Amazing. And so now that you've established with a lot more species these genetic breaks, are there still interest in doing more work in the Papahana Mokuakea Monument?
Yeah, well, and we're still working with the folks at Papahana Mokuakea. And one of the big questions is sort of looking at biodiversity and trying to figure out what this 90% of things down in the reef, If people aren't interested in slugs and sea cucumbers, they're usually interested in fish food, and that's what it translates up the food chain. If we don't have those organisms, we don't have fisheries off of the reefs. That's what makes reefs such productive fisheries areas. And we don't understand what is there. We don't understand what impacts humans are having on it. And so what some of my students have been working on is trying to look at how much difference is there as we move across gradients from Papahanao Mokuakea across a latitudinal, across a population gradient. How different are those populations and what actually lives in the reef? So we make these little reef condos, a cubic foot of basically a fake little reef, and we set them out in the water for a couple of years in collaboration with a bunch of folks at NOAA. We pick them up and we basically look at what has colonized these. And what Kalaunani Hurley has found in her work is that actually, if we look at a depth gradient across one place off of Oahu, if we look at Kiwalo Basin, and you go down from the surface down to 150 meters of depth, you actually find completely different communities than if you go across the entire Hawaiian archipelago from Oahu all the way up to Midway and look at the same depth in shallow water. You have this more similar communities in shallow water than you have across depth gradients in one place. And so it looks like some of these differences, trying to understand latitudinal and anthropogenic gradients, where is driving diversity and what is happening with these communities, is really sort of a focus for trying to understand how do we preserve those things and make sure that reefs are functional in the future, especially in the face of all these climate change factors that that people are worried about.
That's so interesting too, because you know we always think about how different areas are affecting each other, but you don't really think about how some of the deeper species might be influencing shallow communities. So amazing work. If you find little reef apartments or little houses in the water, you're saying leave them. They're part of a research experiment.
They're a long-term experiment.
And speaking of students, I mean, you have had so many students come out of the Tobo Lab, and just incredible people, incredible research, and amazing scientists. They're now professors, marine managers. What do you think are the greatest pathways to success for these students, and how does it feel to be populating this next generation of marine scientists?
I think it's a really incredibly satisfying part of my job is to take people who are really passionate about what they want to do and to try to help them to move on and find careers. And we've seen big changes in sort of student populations through time. And we see, when I was a graduate student, it was mostly men, and they were really interested in sort of basic science questions. Now we have more than 80% of our applicants to graduate programs are female. And we have them very passionate about making, most graduate students now are very passionate about making a difference, trying to have some sort of applied research project that will directly contribute to fisheries or conservation management, providing for the future. And I think the one thing that sort of sets apart the students who make it and the ones who don't, there's so much competition in the job market right now, is the ones who are determined and passionate and self-motivated. If no matter what life throws at you, you're going to make it work for yourself. Those students tend to go on and they tend to do really well for themselves. And the students who are not driven in that way, someone else is going to be more driven. They're going to get the job.
I like it. More females, applied research, and driven students. Yeah. Those are the words of wisdom. Yeah. I love it. Well, hang tight, Rob, because we also have Dr. Judy Lemus on the line. Both Rob and Judy have been huge financial and personal supporters of the All Things Marine radio show, so we certainly appreciate the support. Judy is the PI for Kosi Island Earth, which houses All Things Marine, and is also a tenured faculty specialist also at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. Judy is calling all the way from the every 4 years, the Pacific Educators Conference in Indonesia. Thanks for making some time, Judy.
Hi, Carly. It's great to be on the show.
Welcome. You sound very clear, like you're next door. So how are things going with the conference so far?
Oh, well, it's a great conference. I love it. Actually, happens every years, and it started about 10 years ago as kind of a little branch of the National Marine Educators Association, and there was a group of professionals in the Pacific that thought that, Pacific education and issues and interests and challenges warranted a network of its own, and started these conferences. And so they've actually been going for 10 years now, and I love them because they're fairly small, but you really get a chance to interact with very close. Always have practical experience. So we talk for maybe a day and a half, sometimes 2 days, at a hotel. But then we actually go out and we go into the community. We find out how things work in marine education in that particular community that we're in. We find out what their challenges are. We share ideas. We usually do some kind of service if we can. So it's a really wonderful conference, and this one is no different. It's been great. We started yesterday with talks, and we're going to continue this morning, and then we're going to head out into the field later this afternoon. So it's really wonderful.
Well, it's always great to combine science with and education with some hands-on learning. I know you also have been applying those principles to and a new space at Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology with the Maker Lab. Now, Judy, you're cutting in a little bit in and out there. You sounded like a robot. So let's try and keep the answers a little bit shorter so we can make sure that everybody hears you. But I'm dying to hear about this Maker Lab.
Okay, will do. Yeah, sorry about the connection. The Maker Lab is designed to, it's a space for teachers and undergraduate students that have very little experience in research to come to HIMB and use this space to learn more about the research process and kind of, it's sort of a self-directed lab. That's my idea for it, is to be very student and learner driven. And we want people to just be able to explore, come up with their own questions, and help facilitate their kind of process through answering those questions. And maybe for teachers, take it back into the classroom and use it for their students.
And I love this idea of applying science to teachers and bringing it into the classroom. And that was sort of one of the impetuses behind the Sea Harmony Project. Now, not a dating site for fish, this site, you know, draws on connecting people, both scientists and educators and community. So tell us a little bit about the Sea Harmony Project.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Sea Harmony, as you mentioned, it's a way to connect people. It was, the concept came up with talking to ocean researchers who really wanted to do more outreach and education, but really didn't know how to start. They didn't know who to contact. They didn't really know who would be good collaborators. And so we created Sea Harmony as a social network for professionals working in the area of research or education or management to just find other like-minded professionals and collaborate. So if a researcher wanted to work with a school, they could find a teacher that was interested in the same things and they could build a collaboration.
Now, Sea Harmony was one of the projects under COSI, and unfortunately, COSI has sunset some of the funding for those centers. So what are some of the projects that were developed through that program? Are they continuing, and how are they continuing?
Yes, some of them are definitely continuing. Sea Harmony is one of them, since it was created to be somewhat autonomous. Now that it's built, kind of runs on its own, and we update it periodically, and we post a biweekly sort of news blog on there with new information. So that will continue for sure. And then we also did a project called Traditional Knowledge Teaching Boxes, which we collaborated with a traditional knowledge advisory group, and we came up with these four boxes for teaching through both traditional knowledge and science. And those boxes have actually gone out into the community, and they're being loaned to teachers and other educators. So we have partners on all of the islands that are housing, and they're hosting. I'm sorry, they're hosting these boxes, and they will loan them out to the community. So that will continue as well.
Excellent. That sounds amazing. I'm glad to hear some of these projects are continuing. And in 40 seconds or less, because we're running out of time here, I want to know what's new. Any exciting projects coming up on the horizon?
Okay. Well, Maker Lab is new, and that's really exciting for us. We are in a second phase of a mobile app development that we created for a local fish pond. It's called Loko Ia, which, as you know, means fish pond in Hawaiian. And we're actually we've got some funding from NSF, supplemental funding, to try to develop that a bit further and make it have a broader reach, more useful to more users, and see if we can't develop some sort of template that others can use as well. So that's quite exciting.
Excellent. And these all sound like amazing projects. Sea Harmony is easy enough to find, but if other people want to know more about the Maker Lab, where can they go?
Yeah, the easiest way is to actually just go to my website that they can find through the HIMB website, which is hawaii.edu/HIMB. There's a faculty page. I'm listed there, and they can get more information on the Maker Lab through my page.
Mahalo Nui Loa Judy. I'm so excited that you could be here today to talk to us, and I wish you a lot of luck with the conference for the rest of the week. I want to give a big thanks to all my guests today who have joined us here, and not just the guests in the studio, but everyone who's joined us over the past 4 years. There's so much to talk about. The conversations can continue, and I hope that all my guests will come back with more updates on the fantastic work that they're doing. I'd like to give a special thanks to those working behind the scenes, Chaz, Patrick, and the team at Salem Media, and certainly a special thanks to Rob and Judy and those at Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology for their support over the years. Keep listening, and I hope we have another few years of interesting marine science and conservation topics to share with our Hawaii ohana. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.